Today I want to talk about, we're learning Parashat Miketz in the middle of Hanukkah, and I guess in the world is going to hell in a handbasket. Can we all agree on that? Like, it really is unbelievable, and it raises questions. It raises questions that are larger questions, which is, and I think that the Parsha does this in a very small way that sometimes is overlooked, and raises the question we have to ask ourselves. Very often, or almost always, when the world goes to hell in a handbasket, we always ask ourselves, well, what do we do? What do we have to do? We have to fix it. We have to change it. You know what I'm saying? Like, how are we going to deal with Islamic terror or global warming? Rina's coming, so let's bring another chair, if you don't mind. Okay?
There's a chair.
Okay. Yeah, there's more here. We have many more. Okay? So, it's all fine. But we don't ask the other question, which is significantly harder to ask, which is, why is this happening? Like, what is going on in the world? And is there something that we could do to address the underlying cause? You understand what I'm saying? And everybody asks themselves the question, for example, and I'm not going to deign to even think about having an answer. Like, what the hell is going on with all this Islamic terrorism? Like, you know, the whole world really seems to be going crazy. But nobody else seems to be asking the question, why is it happening? Why is it appropriate? Like, what is wrong with the world that needs to be fixed? Instead of just killing all the terrorists, it's like whack-a-mole. You know the game whack-a-mole?
Yeah.
You whack one down, and it comes up somewhere else.
Right?
That doesn't solve the problem. What solves the problem? If you ask yourself the more important question, which is, why is this happening? But nobody wants to ask that question because it goes to places that they're not able to answer. What?
It's not comfortable to answer.
Correct. The people that have to ask that question are religious leaders, spiritual leaders. They have to ask that question. But nobody wants spiritual answers when you know, physical questions.
Have you heard of Rabbi Naftali Brown?
I know the name. I have heard the name.
In the dish, they have a short little shiur on BBC Radio 4 yesterday morning.
Really?
And he was talking about how the time that you left Hanukkah is sort of dusk. And he was talking about how important faith is. It doesn't give you clarity. It's not a black and white, it's a day and night. It's that dusk.
Yeah.
And some things are hidden and some things are revealed. And the importance of candlelight. And you don't understand.
Remind me at the end, I have a beautiful idea about the time of the candle lighting, similar to that. I'm also impressed that BBC has someone giving...
religious thoughts?
Wow. Okay, so I want to ask that question in the context of the famine in Egypt. Because we all take for granted that there's going to be a famine in Egypt, and we read about it. But we then fail to ask the more important question, why was there a famine in Egypt? You know what I'm saying? So we're going to see there's a bunch of interesting different perspectives that are sort of hidden into the, like, woven into the fabric of the psukim and some of the mefarshim that try to address this question. Because you're talking about the major geopolitical event of its time, right, that affected all the inhabitants of the world in which we're concerning ourselves, the Middle East. So why does it happen? Like, what's the purpose of it? And we're going to have, obviously, a Jewish-centered focus, but also a more global-centered focus, an Egypt-centered focus as well. Okay, so I want to begin... Actually took notes. With the notion of the dreams, turn to Mem Aleph, the beginning of Miketz. Okay, and we know Paro's dreams, right? Like, the leader of the free world, or the leader of the major country in the world, has dreams, and these dreams are not just dreams. These dreams are significant. Not only are they significant, they really are a message from God. You with me, Anna? Like, I'm getting this blank stare. They're a message from God about what's going to happen. He just doesn't know how to interpret them. Okay, so let's just remember, he has these two dreams. What are his two dreams? First, he dreams that there are seven fat cows and seven skinny cows. The seven skinny cows eat the seven fat cows and they don't get fat. Then he has another dream, there's seven fat stalks of wheat, seven thin stalks of wheat, the seven thin stalks eat the seven fat stalks, they don't get fat. He has no idea what it means. Okay, they drag Yosef out of the pit. Okay, and here we go. Look at Mem Aleph Tetvav. Mem Aleph Tetvav. We're gonna just do a skip a little bit, and then we're gonna learn the midrashim. Vayomer Paro al Yosef. So Paro says to Yosef, Chalam chalamti upoter enoto. Okay, I dreamt a dream. What does the word poter mean? What's the
A solver.
A solver, right? And we translate it to mean an interpreter. Okay? When a poter chalomot, we're going to see in a second that it's not so clear what the job of the poter chalomot is. I'll lead you in a second.
It's interesting the wording, though.
Okay.
Poter ein oto.
What?
It's interesting the wording, no?
Poter ein oto. There was only two. Va'ani shamati alecha. I heard about you.
Interpreter of dreams.
Interpreter of dreams? I don't know. Okay, you hear dreams to interpret them. Go back a second. What?
Oh, well, there's a potifar.
Yeah, two pace. Go back to Yud Gimel. Go back to Yud Bet. One second. Go back to Yud Bet a second. Go back for a few psukim in Yud Bet. It does?
It's not one of the throwaway letters that you add or
take. Right, not
like
right.
Potifar. Three
days. Yeah, that's right. It's an Egyptian name. It's an Egyptian name. Okay. We're going to go back a few psukim. The minister of beer and wine, okay, he's remembering when he was back in jail. He says to Paro, we have these dreams. Look at your bet. Mishamitanu nar ivri, ever the sarat tabachim. There was a Hebrew servant to the Sarat Abachim, Vanasapar lo vayiftar lanu, and he patar. Liftor, pitaron is a resolution, is a solution. He solved our dreams. Ish kechalomo patar. Each one according to his dream. Vayihi kasher patar lanu kein haya. The way he interpreted it was, Oti heishiv al kani, v'oto tala. Right? He, Oti heishiv al kani,
innocence.
What does it say?
Post.
He returned me heshiv al kani v'oto tala.
He was hung.
What?
No, him.
Let me ask you a different question. Heshiv al kani means what?
Returned to my post.
Heshiv.
I thought innocence.
Who heshiv?
Returned
me to my post. Who returned me to my post?
This ivri.
No, he didn't. The interpreter.
You understand?
Yeah.
Right. The language implies that who is doing the returning?
The interpreter.
The interpreter.
Yeah, the
Ivri.
Okay. But why would he even think that Yosef?
Says the Midrash. Says I'll read you a story from Breshit Rabbah that you don't have in this great blue chumash. Okay. Vayikasher patar lanu kein haya. Says the Midrash. Isha achat halcha etzel Rabbi Lezer. So a woman went to Rabbi Lezer and said, "Ra'iti b'chalom shashniya, right, the roof shebabayit nivka'a. I had this dream that my roof caved in." That's a bad dream. So she went to him. So what did he say? So he said to her, "Amar la Rabbi Lezer." Rabbi Lezer said, "Tit abri v'teldi ben zachar." It means you're going to have a male child. Okay. V'halcha meito v'chein haya. Same thing. It happened. Wonderful. Right? Again it happened, and she had the same dream, she told him the dream. You're going to have a male child. And that's exactly what happened. Third time she went to Rabbi Lezer, she had the same dream, and she couldn't find him. By the way, it's an interesting question why she keeps coming, she has the same dream, but okay.
Yeah.
And she says, so he wasn't there, his students were there. Ra'iti, she says, I saw the dream.
I think it's unusual she's looking for him.
Each time.
I think that's part of the issue.
Wait, hold on. And he said, she went to him, she couldn't find him. She went, so she goes to his students, right? They're sitting there, what do you want? They tell him the story. It means that you're going to, bury your husband. Your husband's going to die. V'chein haya. Shamar Rabbi Lezer kol tzvacha. So Rabbi Lezer hears her screaming. Hears her crying. Amar le mazot. He says, what's going on? Sipru lo et ma'aseh. So they told him the story. Amar lehem haragtem ish. You killed a man. Loken katuv vayihi kasher patar lanu kein haya. It was in the way that the dream was interpreted.
By the way, you're not translating it.
No,
Kasher. When he explained it for us, that's what happened.
V'chein katuv.
Well, that's the first time you said it. The first time you read it, you're not translating it clearly.
V'hi kasher patar lanu.
When he interpreted.
Well, wait. Kasher means not when.
When.
Kasher.
Kasher. When.
Yeah.
Okay.
When it happened.
I understood kasher to mean as if.
Show me another pasuk of kasher or another use of the word.
Unglus vahaya kima di pashar lanu. Kima, not ka'an. Kima, kimo.
What does kima mean?
Kimo. As the way.
So in another example.
Okay. Okay. Velo katuv kein haya kasher batar lanu. Lomar, to tell us, shachalom holev achar hapitaron. Everybody's got the...
Yeah.
To tell us that the dream follows the pitaron. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, kol achalomot tolchim achar hapeh, shel hapoter. The dream follows the interpreter. The dream does not follow the dream.
So that means it's a huge responsibility to interpret the dream.
Yeah.
So the baker killed the baker.
What can you do? You can't save everyone. Yeah, that's true. That's a good question. But
I imagine there are multiple possible interpretations of a dream, and the interpreter has to find...
Well, he must always find a positive one.
Now you understand why nobody liked, the power didn't like everybody's interpretation of the dream. Right? Everybody said the seven fat cows. What?
He was also trying to save himself.
Yeah.
His interpretation. Yeah, but, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm saying it's like, it's a very interesting game of cat and mouse that there's a dream. The dream means something, but the dream has this, but the person...
That's like a rabbi interpreting halakha. They all get a certain occurrence, and then you can get five rabbis with a different...
It's very different.
Yeah.
Because they have to interpret that doesn't... It's not the outcome that... that control, it's the person that controls that, the rabbi.
But halakha is like a fact. A dream is like a...
No, but the fact is changed by the different...
Reading or a lot.
Your comment makes you on the one hand nervous, but it's also accurate. There's a lot of truth to that. That the halakha is it's more accurate, probably as accurate as you mean it to be. The halakha is not established by the book. The book doesn't establish the halakha. The rav who's the posek establishes the halakha. That's a very important misunderstanding or misinterpretation of people's understanding of halakha. Right, the bindingness, and this is, and it's one of the, that's one of the messages of that sugya of Tamir Shemach Nai. It isn't an absolute fact. The Chachamim are the ones that establish the halacha. They establish the reality, and this seems to be the same here, that there are these dreams and they have this meaning, but it has to be interpreted in order for them to come true, in order for them to happen. And we see this, Na'ari Vri has this ability. What he said took place. But they don't see it as, well, it's this prediction of the future, and then he's able to unravel it, as much as it's this sort of guide, and he's able to sort of mold it in the way that he understands. And that's exactly what Paro is looking for. Okay? And we're going to see this exactly in 1 second. So that's exactly what Paro says. So Yosef comes back, and Paro says, I see, you know how to... Tishma chalom liftor oto. Vayan Yosef et paro lemor bil adai Elohim yaneh et shlom paro. Right? And this is one of the things that Chazal says. What brought Yosef's redemption is that he doesn't say it's me. It's God. God will sort of guide me. Okay? And so he tells him the whole dream. Skip to Pasuk Chavei. Mam Aleph Chavei. Vayamer Yosef el paro. Chalom paro echad hu. Et asher Elohim oseh, higid leparo. That which God is going to do, he told to paro. So, and by the way, if you think this is true, then this brings us back to our original question. Why did God want to do this? And why did he want to tell paro about it? Meaning it's a sort of like double-edged sword. If you're going to bring a famine to the world, then it's a punishment, it's a painful thing, it's a terrible thing. Then why are you telling us about it? So if you're telling you about it, then is that obviously it's in some way to mitigate the whole pain of the famine. So what in the world is going on with this famine here? Okay, so it's interesting. Sheva parot atovot, sheva shanim heina. The sheva shivalim atovot, sheva shanim heina, chalom echadu. Right? The parot are seven years. The cows are 7 years. The stalks are 7 years. It's one dream. V'sheva parot ha-rakot ha-ra'ot olater m'sheva shanim heima v'sheva shivalim ha-rakot shduvot ha-kadim m'sheva shanim heima. Okay, it's all one dream. There's only one problem with this. What's the problem with Yosef's interpretation? Very interesting question. Okay, what does Yosef do? How many dreams does Pharaoh have?
Two.
Two. How many, what does Yosef say that they are?
One dream.
One dream. Okay, and in the end, Yosef says, in Vali Shanot, if you skip to Lamed Bet, Vali Shanot HaChalom HaPharaoh Pa'amayim, Ki Nechona Devar Me'el Me'elohim U'meher La'asoto. Right? So the whole dream is really good. Everything makes a lot of sense, and like it really fits, except...
Why have it twice?
Why have two dreams, one about cows, one about stocks?
No, it's the same thing.
Yeah, but why?
What's the dream? The dream is...
No, because
Miss Literature, right? If you had a poem,
no.
Right? And you were interpreting some Yeatsy and whatever, and right, you have two stanzas, right?
Yeah.
Would he write the same thing twice?
It's not the same thing, though. Not the same thing.
So Yosef had two dreams that were the same meaning but in different interpretations.
They weren't the same.
One was the brothers, one was the parents.
Yes. They were totally different.
Well, the first one didn't get his attention.
First one didn't get his attention?
So
why would you say that? No, he dreamt it twice in one night.
So, no, maybe it's wheat
cows
plus...
Cows is first.
Okay, so maybe you would think that the reason that the cows would be skinny was because of an illness. It wasn't an illness, it was because of a lack of wheat.
So just have the wheat.
That's the second one.
Just have one.
So one it takes the animals and one the agriculture.
Wow, like just one.
One animal, one.
Yosef says, it's one dream. Va'ali shanot ha'chalom ha'paro pa'amayim, ki nachon ha'davar me'im Elohim, u'memaher Elohim la'asoto.
Because if it was
together, it's the economy.
Because they must not be the same thing twice.
What? By the way, livestock to them is what?
The same thing twice.
What's livestock to them?
Gods.
They're gods.
No, only the sheep.
The what?
Just
gods?
The sheep? Not the cows?
The cows.
No,
the cows.
India
is the cows.
Yeah, but in
Abodazar,
it is a god.
It's a... Isn't it? I don't know. Anyway, so everything about the dream, you're like, yeah, that's right. Power's like, yeah, that's right. Except this one, it doesn't fit. It's a little weird. No? You don't think so?
No.
Sorry, the Midrash does think so. Okay? Right?
He didn't get the message the first time.
He didn't get the message? He woke up that morning.
It's an anxiety that's repeating itself. Just the same thing over and over.
What? Right.
Have your Freudian one.
Okay. Says the Midrash. Yudalit shanah sherav hayu reuyin labo. They're really supposed to have been 14 years of famine. Okay. Sheva parot v'sheva shivali. 4 and 4. Rabbi Nechemya Omer.
7 and 7.
Rabbi Nechemya Omer. Rabbi Nechemya says kafchet shana. It should have been 28 years. Why? Because the dream was really repeated twice. First in the telling, and then it was repeated again when Paro repeated it. I.e., the Torah could have just said, Paro told the dreams to Yosef. But it doesn't. It goes through the whole thing. Okay?
Well, but why does that add yours?
Each time it's said.
Yeah. Ela, shegazar Yosef, v'na'asu sheva shanim. Yosef said, he Yosef understood, right? He changed it. And he made a gzeirah, and said 14 years. He said 7 years instead of 14. Davar acher, yihyu lashon tfila. Yosef David. Shemin adin haya layot mem bet shanim sharav. It's supposed to be 42. I don't know exactly how they got to 42. Va'al yidei tfilat Yosef nichzeru ad shiva. Yosef brought it down to 7, but it wasn't 7 in the end. How many was it?
14.
In the end? Ukshaba Yaakov, and when Yaakov came, nichzeru ad shnei shanim. Right, there was only 2 years in the end. You know, there was only 2 years of famine. And it's supposed to be 42 to 28 to 14. Yosef said, no,
like
7 years.
Oh,
very good, right. It's supposed to be 400 years, and it ended up being 210 years. But there's this idea that it's not locked in stone. There's no concrete. You know, the dreams have a certain interpretation, but the interpreter has the ability to mold the dream to his interpretation, to his
Although
own understanding.
It's weird because it's only molding the dream, molding reality. Meaning, it's a fact. Famine. Is it going to be 28 years or is it going to be? It's very different.
I'll let you know.
That's what he says. He controls reality.
Yeah.
How are you saying?
That's why Tfilah makes sense.
Oh,
yeah.
So the idea obviously is that not everybody can do this.
No.
Right? Only Yosef HaTzadik can do this.
Right.
As we're going to see. Right, that is really the notion of the interpretation, the understanding, that it's not anybody who's able to interpret, but someone who's on the level of a poter talamot.
This theme appears in, it's not just in the Torah, I mean, it's also in other cultures, have this idea of somebody giving a curse and somebody else with equal power being able to mitigate the curse, not to remove the curse, but to mitigate it. Mm-hmm.
of equal power.
Yeah.
Like
even in fairy tales.
That's the thing I just read Laurie Beauty last night.
It's what you just said, it made me think of what Laurie said, of what Laura said.
Laurie,
thank you. Okay. Because what you just made me think right immediately of the connection between halakha. There's an inyan of gzar beitin, that if a beitin makes a halakha, even if the halakha, the reason for the halakha doesn't exist anymore, you can change it. A beitin can change it only if it's larger, big gadlut u'beminyan,
right,
in stature and in size. Mm-hmm. I.e., you need the Sanhedrin of Shivim Mishnayim, you need 70 to the Sanhedrin of 72 Dayanim in order to change the halakha today. And there's this notion it's a very interesting notion. I've heard it a number of times about the idea that when Chazal made a din, when they made a halakha, right, there's many, many reasons. The Vilna Gaon has a whole theme about this, that there's a lot of understanding and reasons behind it. If we don't just throw away halakha, the reason no longer exists. Like I brought this up vis-a-vis the idea of Hanukkah. This will come in if you remind me at the end, the idea of Hanukkah. Like, the reason why we light a Hanukkah, according to the explicit halakha, we know why we light the halakha, to keep for to remember the nes. But why do we light the neir of Hanukkah? The mitzvah is right after either Shkia or Tzedek Kol Chavim, the half an hour right after, you know, you finish lighting, the light goes down. And the reason is because they say, Ad shechaleh regel min hashuk. The whole purpose is that's when people are still walking around. So you want it to be when people are still around, so that they're walking around and they see the lights of the Hanukkah candles. So Rav Hillel Mertzbach was talking about, you know, he gives a little bar alecha every morning in shul, and he spoke about this idea. You have half an hour in order to light, according to the most poskim, you know. And then he said, you know, you really today you can go longer, and even when your husband comes home, even later. But lecha chili is supposed to really make a very strong effort to light right away, right as soon as it gets dark. And so I said to him, have you seen anybody who talks about this notion of the fact that this halacha seems totally irrelevant today? I.e., it's not. There's no more people walking around between 4:30 or 5 and 5:30 than they are at 8 o'clock at night. I said, if you really wanted more Pesumei Nisa, more people to see the lights, you should say, you know, you should light at 7 or 7:30 when people are coming home from work. Mm-hmm. You know, like it really hit home to me when you everybody was here when they had the power outage. Everybody's here, you know, like it was so different. It was so interesting. We walked to our, you know, our host. We were eating out. It was so quiet. It was like everybody, like when, like normally you're like a Friday night, people are still walking around. Nobody's walking around. It was pitch black. That's because when it's pitch black, nobody wants to be outside. You know what I'm saying? That really hit home, this idea of Yichaleh Regel Min Hashuk, that nobody's around anymore. So I said, have you ever seen anybody, any modern writers, write about this idea? So he sent me an article. I think, I'm pretty sure he wrote to Rabbi Tzuriel. There's a rabbi named Rabbi Moshe Tzuriel, lives in Bnei Brak. He's a very well-known rabbi. And he wrote a thing based on the Maharal. And I'll give it to you at the end. But there's this notion that, like, even though Chazal gave the reason, so I was talking, I had this tiyul, and I was speaking to my boss, Rav Gutel. And so I mentioned him in this Maharal, that I'll tell you in the end. And he said, there's this notion in the Vilna Gaon that even though Chazal gave a reason and said it's Pesumei Nisa, there's like many, many deeper reasons for the halakha that's based upon, that's much more broad and deep than just the reason that they gave you. So you don't just throw away halakha because the reason is no longer relevant. You need people who have an understanding, not just of the reason they gave you, but of the deeper reasons before you say, oh, well, I don't have to keep that halakha anymore. What's that? There are deeper reasons. There are. That's what they say. It's a very interesting thing. That made me think of what you said, like the dream. You can't undo a dream until somebody greater. There's a notion of establishing something. There's an established fact. We said the Chazal establish a reality. They establish it, and in order to unestablish it, you have to have somebody of great stature. You know, it's part of our Masorah.
It's all connected to, like, when they say you can't read futures and read palms and you can only tell good things, because the minute they say a bad thing, then it's, you know, you've always got to be lad, staka, and
there is a notion of even hadyotot about tiftach peh, that we don't say something. That's it, ayin hara, right?
The whole idea about reading people's future, that if you say something bad and you may turn it into a reality opposed to. That you can only say the good things.
There definitely is a notion of saying bad things and they come into reality. There definitely is that notion.
Yeah.
There is that concept.
Yeah.
Right, that we don't... Yeah, you don't want to...
The minute you say it out loud, it becomes...
But even in that case, it's not just with attempt and fate issue. Then you're dealing with people's emotions already.
Right.
If somebody hears something negative, there's... When you said before, the self-fulfilling prophecy...
They become obsessive. It becomes
negativity.
See, but that's a much more. I don't think that it was. In traditionally, it's not. That's not part of it. It's not a psychology thing. It's not a mentality issue.
But I'm just saying, with Yirmiyahu, then he predicted the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and people were very angry with him. We say, well, he was right. Like
well, God came to him and told him to say it. In that case, God. But he was probably warning them to change.
Right.
So just so I mentioned the whole question, I just want to tell you that I was going to say this, I'll tell you at the end. The whole idea, so Rav Tsuriel wrote in his article, why do we light right after, why is it important to light right after the when it gets dark? He says there are two forces in the world, the force of light and the force of darkness. He said darkness represents the idea that we're all in God's hands, right? That everything, that we're quiet and we can't do anything and we hunker down, and that's the notion of the koach of God in the night. But the koach of the light is when we go out in there in the day and we do and we're active. Okay, so what's interesting, he said, is that the world, like, we stand between these two forces. Sometimes we have to wait and God has to save us totally, and that's the koach of the laila. You know, when the Jews came out of Egypt, it was Hashem yilachem lachem, and you have to be quiet and you don't do anything. Whereas during the time of Yom, we're expected to go out and do on our own. So the koach of Chanukah was at a time of where it wasn't explicit that we did it on our own. It was somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we were supposed to do the fighting, the Maccabim had to fight, but there's this notion and understanding that God is helping us, God is behind us, God is fighting for us. You know, there's this very famous quote in the Sefer HaMaccabim, when Yehuda HaMaccabee wants to go and like attack these like huge Assyrian army, and he says, we can be Rabim Yad Me'atim, but God has the ability to give the masses in our hands if we believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, he says that's the notion of the Koach Hayom into the night. That this force of we fight, but nonetheless we believe that it's really God acting behind us. So he says, Seb Tsuriel writes, the reason why we light immediately at the night is even if it's Sha'ot Laila, even if it's a time of night, nonetheless we believe that it's the force of HaKadosh Baruch Hu guiding us behind. And that's the notion of Pesume Nisa, to take from the Koach of Yom, that we still have to do the fighting. And it's very like, you know, Zionist perspective. And it's really like he's one of the leading Zionist rabbis. He quotes the Maharal, but it's a very beautiful idea that we're fighting, but on the other hand, we believe that our fighting is, you know, that the Kadosh Baruch Hu is guiding us, and it's Rabim Biad Miatim. Yeah.
But that's, like, I mean, I really like what you said, but it's not exactly a reason for it. It's more like a time, like more like an explanation.
Yeah.
No, it's just an interesting thing that you talk about, like about halakhic innovation and when the reason changes in the modern time, does the halakha fall away, or do you have to find a new reason, or do you have to find like a time for it? Do you know what
I mean? I will be perfectly honest and say this: the whole theme of the Vilna Gaon bothers me very much. I find it, you know what I'm saying, that we're, and Rabbi Gutel said this, he said, it very much locks halakha into place. And let's not think for a moment that the Vilna Gaon statement wasn't also a political statement. Remember the churnings of religious history at the time, and the fear of, it was Reform, that wasn't Reform yet, but I'm sure it was Hasidic. He was very afraid of halachic innovation and change. And people came along and said, this is no longer relevant.
It's a worldwide revolution.
That's right.
The American Revolution.
Yeah. Right.
Do you remember, like, just on Shabbos about medicines? Like, what's
that's the example I always think of. That's the example I always think of.
And we're having this whole discussion about it, and it just, we need a new...
So just understand that in medicine also, that idea comes up, and I can send you sources if you're interested, about post-communist, exactly that thing. Whereas Chazal's, you know, even though it's not relevant, who knows what the underlying reason is, and who can say exactly that quote?
You can't just go throwing things out.
You can't just go throwing things away. Right.
And it's good to get, like, another, like this, what you just gave us, and, like, really strong perspective, then, like, okay, now I understand, that's good.
I find it, but I think, but it also, on the one hand, it locks you in a lot of ways. If we felt that way, then we wouldn't be here today. You understand what I'm saying? So there's a fine balance between having a healthy dose of respect for what was
and health and halakhic innovation, right.
Halakha has to innovate, and also like the idea of Pursume Nisa of promoting the miracle, like for me, like here you have, like, you know, it's light outside, we don't know what darkness is anymore, there's no such thing as night, it doesn't exist anymore. And
someone,
so yeah,
something about
what?
Someone posted something about hectares, how there's a hectare, there's a hectare mechira, there's a
case of Shani, there's all these hedges for all these things in halakha.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, I saw that. I wanted to respond to that. So I thought, so the answer is like this. The answer is like this. The answer is exactly what we went to. My, we're so far afield, but it's okay. Right? Do you want to finish what you want to say? It's important that everybody understand what you're talking about. No, it's important everybody understand what you're talking about. There's this need, this theme going on the internet that, you know, you can find a solution for everything, but you can't find a solution for agunot. Right? And if you really wanted to, you could find a solution. The answer is, technically, there's truth to that. That if the rabbis wanted to. And it's not that they don't want to. Right? The problem is the solution creating more of a problem than it's solving a problem? Right? The problem, on the one hand, is a terrible problem of aguna, it's a terrible problem of chil Hashem, but it's a very limited problem. Right?
Not
for the person in it, but it's a small, small, tiny percentage of. Okay? You have to ask yourself, why are rabbis against the solutions? I understand.
Because they're going to make all marriages and push the children.
Oh. The question is the solution a good solution, or does it have you can solve a problem. What's the problem? The problem is, the solution is, we can make every marriage conditional. Right? You can say every marriage is conditional, and therefore anybody can annul a marriage. Do you really think that it's a good idea to make every marriage in a person's mind conditional, that it can be annulled based on your decision, based on a whim?
There could be other solutions.
There are, no, that's the only solution.
Why?
How else are you going to have a solution? How are you going to undo a fact that when a husband and wife marry, then if the husband is recalcitrant, then it's not really a marriage? You know, marriage is a halakhic construct.
Aren't there conditions anyway? In a person's mind, there are conditions.
It doesn't work that way.
Certain things.
I mean, the idea is that, I've been thinking about this. The notion of the bond between a husband and wife is the bedrock of Judaism. It is the foundation of all Jewish life. Right? The Bayit B'Yisrael. Bayit Ne'eman B'Yisrael. And for this laudable goal of preventing agunot, what you want to do is then say, every Bayit Ne'eman B'Yisrael is not really Ne'eman. Because you could go to a Beit Din and undo it. What does that do in the minds of, like, every, let me tell you, every couple that comes here.
That's true.
Every, with Sora couple that I meet with now, I have this great question I always ask them. Why are you getting married? Like, because, you know, you guys are living together, right? You are. You have your own house. You have your own apartment. What are you getting married for? And they always, like, interesting, when you ask that question, they're like, I'm the head. They don't really know.
But don't they normally say they want children?
So what? You can have children now.
Yeah, but...
But
do people feel that they want their children to grow up in a stable environment? Yeah.
What makes it stable? What makes that more stable?
There's a status also.
Oh, you understand what I'm saying? Halacha values that status.
Yeah.
Now, what you want to do then is go ahead and create a construct which then weakens in a legal, fundamental way. You want to undermine that construct. And so, is that worth it? Is it worth it to do for everyone?
No, but there must be other ways.
Yeah. See, but you think...
For example, after the Yom Kippur War, when the Rabbanim said, okay, we're going to declare all the Nedarim mating.
They did not do that.
They did.
They did not do that.
Well, they should have.
They did not do that. They took different kinds of testimony. They looked at different kinds of witnesses. They did not do that. You can't do that.
Okay, so
they would never do that.
Okay,
do you understand? On a case-by-case basis.
But so same thing.
Here, it doesn't work that way.
Case by case.
It doesn't work that way. There's no. Every solution, as you well know, as we all know, every medicine that you take, the more medicines you take, the more you complicate things. You can't solve a problem without creating an underlying solution.
But a person gets married through the state and through...
Meaning, like, let's say chametz. Let's say the sale of chametz. The sale of chametz, on the one hand, is a tremendous kula, correct? Is a tremendous leniency that you can sell your chametz and it's sitting in your house. But on the other hand, the rabbis understand, like, what does that have the danger of doing? It has a danger of weakening our how should we say this? Are aversion to chametz. So they did other things, on the other hand, to make it so strict that today the notion that anybody would have any chametz in their house is like an anathema.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying? They created this balance in order to make sure that on the one hand we allow, on the other hand we don't. You know what I'm saying? There's this understanding. But people don't understand is that there's this thing that bothers me. Aguna is terrible. We can acknowledge aguna is horrible. It's a tremendously terrible thing. So solve it. Do you really want that solution? You do? Not at the cost of undermining Jewish marriage.
No,
you want me to solve the problem without any cost. You want me to solve the problem?
It needs to be dealt with, as you say,
case by case. Case by case.
doesn't work that way.
It's more important than time.
You're a nasty man. I'm going to undo your marriage. How do you do that?
But how does it undo my marriage because someone else is free from
them? They can undo it if a woman won't give the gift.
What?
They
that's Gzeirat HaKetuv. The Torah says a woman doesn't give the gift. It's Gzeirat HaKetuv.
A woman has to accept the gift.
She has to accept. But the Gzeirat HaKetuv is...
But how many men are stuck in this position that the woman won't take the gift?
Many. More than you could imagine. Oh, yes. Go to the Beit Din. Many.
Yeah, all yours. And I don't think...
Many. By the way, the problem of Agunah, by the way, the ones you hear about, the vast majority of Chutz La'aretz.
The
vast majority.
Not the Agunah, because that's different.
What's Agunah?
It's not the vast majority of Chutz La'aretz.
Yeah, it is.
They're locked
here. No, there aren't.
For example,
because they don't drag on, because they can throw them in jail. If it gets bad, the rabbis can throw them in jail.
Really?
Very bad. Yes. But you can't do it in Chutz La'aretz. Rabbis have no power in Chutz La'aretz. Yeah.
What about the fact
that we're totally
making money?
We're going in this direction. But okay,
what about
yeah.
the fact that necessarily someone who's being refused a gift? She could be someone whose husband is missing.
Oh, the classic case of a gunah has nothing to do with the refusal of a gift. Someone's missing. The rabbis try. They go. There are very, very, very rare cases where a rabbi will say, "I can't. I don't. This is not enough." The very rare cases, but usually they can help that case. That's not the gunah we're talking about.
Yeah,
here we talk about recalcitrant husbands, bad people.
My uncle went into a coma at 29.
I was about to say something like that.
Yeah.
And his wife, after 14 years,
they gave her a gift. So by the way, the rabbi said, there was a very famous case, a very, very famous, very recent case. There's a very famous case in Tzfat of a woman whose husband, Lo Aleinu, was in a traffic accident and he became a vegetable. And the Beit Din did issue a get. One second. They issued not a get, they did it all day, zikui and meriting. And you should understand, this is unbelievably controversial. Incredibly halachically questionable. Based on, you're talking about the vast, vast majority of rabbinic opinions
were
very much against it. And these rabbis were not appointed. Anyone who had anything to do with this did not get, like, appointments to rabbinic appointments after the fact because of this, because they didn't agree with it. And that's, by the way, I think that's legitimate. It wasn't a political thing. It was a halachic thing. You know what I'm saying? And they strongly disagreed with the logic.
On the other hand, you also have people that their husbands, let's say, went missing, and then they decide, well, I'm stuck, and they got married, and they continue with their lives.
And they create mamzerim. It's a horrible, it's a heart-wrenching situation. It's a terrible situation. Not every solution. Doctors can't solve every problem. They can't. Why are rabbis expected to be able to solve every problem? I can't solve every tragedy.
What about the fact that these husbands are taking money from their wives that want gets?
Oh, that's terrible.
They're allowing this.
Who's allowing
it? They have to pay their husbands off tons of money, whether they have the money or not.
You should understand.
Sometimes it's in the bedroom.
You should understand. Every situation, every person has leverage, right, in the court system. So people abuse their leverage in order to extort money. It happens on the husband's side and happens on the wife's side. It happens. Now, you hear about the cases more often what happens on the husband's side, and the law is very much in favor of preventing it from happening from the woman's side. But it happens in both cases. Like, it happens a lot where a husband wants to get divorced, and the woman says, I don't want to get divorced. I can't stand my husband, but, financially it works for me. So she can drag out the process for years. She can, and it happens all the time. You just don't hear about these things. But it happens all the time. Because every legal system where people have power give the opportunity for abusing that power. That's just the way the nature of humanity and the nature of people. And divorce is a very nasty thing. And we shouldn't know from such things, but it allows people the opportunity to become things that they're not. Things that nobody would want to be. Okay. And we were saying, we were talking about... I got 5 minutes? Okay. We're talking about dreams. We're talking about the purpose of the famine.
Really off topic.
Hold on. The famine comes. Skip to Mem Aleph Nun He, the end of Mem Aleph. I'm sorry, Nun Gimel. Mem Aleph Nun Gimel. Batichlena Sheva Shnei Hasava Asher Haya Bimitzrayim. Mem Aleph Nun Gimel. The end of the verse. The 7 years of Sova, the 7 years of plenty ended. But, okay, Vatichilena, interesting, Vatichlena and Vatichilena, see that alliteration, totally different words. Mm-hmm. Tichlena from Lechalot, ended. Tchilena from?
Started.
Lehatchil. Vatichlena, Vatichilena, Sheva Shnei Ra'ablavo, Kaasher Amar Yosef. You like that? See those words? Now what does Kaasher Amar Yosef mean?
Which
person? You don't know where I am?
Well, we know.
Nun Aleph, Nun Dalet.
Nun Aleph, Nun Dalet.
Yeah.
No, Mem Aleph.
I said Mem? I'm sorry, Mem Aleph, Nun Dalet. Mem Aleph. There is no
Nun. Nun Gimel and Nun Dalet.
Where are you? You are. I sidetracked all of you about Aguna. You got me started.
No, because the previous pasuk was also got a...
Yeah, Batich Lena and Batich Lena. Isn't it interesting? There's an interesting play on words. Okay? Nun Dalet. Vatichilena Sheva Shnei Ra'ablavo Kasher Amar Yosef. What does Kasher Amar Yosef mean? Now, and according to our interpretation?
Like he said.
As Yosef had?
Said.
Had said. But it doesn't mean as he had predicted as
or
much
interpreted.
As he brought about. Kasher Amar Yosef. Vayhi Ra'abachol Arzot Bechol Eretz Mitzrayim Hayal Lechem. Nun Hay. Vatir'av Kol Eretz Mitzrayim. So they're all hungry. Vayitzak ha'am el paro lalachem. So Paro cries out, so they cry to Paro. Vayomer Paro, l'chol mitzrayim, so what does Paro say? L'chol el Yosef, asher yomar lachem ta'asu. Do whatever he says to you. Now what's Yosef going to say for them? What's Yosef supposed to tell them?
Well, he gives them grain.
Yeah, he's supposed to give them food. What in the world does this mean? Asher yomar lachem ta'asu. Okay, what does he mean? Look at Rashi. Crazy Rashi, based on an even crazier Midrash. Okay, I'll show you Amar Lachem Tasu.
I mean, there must be guidelines how, okay, I'm giving you for a week, this is, break it up for each day.
He didn't give them anything.
That's what it was.
He didn't give them anything.
Yeah, the Abba.
By the way, what would the first thing, if you were Paro, you would say?
He did it, guys.
What would Yosef, what would you say to Paro? What would you say?
Instructions.
What would you say to them? If they came to you and they said, we need food, well, the first week, so what would you say if you were Paro? Did you say anything? Save anything? We've been screaming at you for 7 years that there's going to be a famine.
Didn't you put it away sign
of it? No, what about you? Forget me. What did you do?
But isn't there an idea that their food rotted?
Says the Rashi. Very good. Nefi shehaya Yosef emor lahem shiyamulu. Yosef said, you want food? No problem. Circumcise yourselves. Ukshabau etel paru v'omrim kachu omer lanu. What?
Why would they do that?
Right. Okay, let me read you the Midrash. Let me read you the Midrash.
This is Nun Dalet?
Right? Wait a second. Lama nizkako litzavotam alkach. What in the world is Paro saying to them? Kevan she'in chazek ha'ra'av ba'aretz, itkatsu ha'mitzvim u'ba'a weitzah Yosef. I'm reading the Midrash, based on the Rashi's based on. So they all came to Yosef. Amru lo t'nei lanu lechem, give us food. Amar lehem, Elohai eino zanet ha'arilim. My God doesn't feed uncircumcised. Go circumcise yourself, and I'll give you bris. Bris milah. So they're like, So they went to Paro and they said, what the, you know, we're not doing that. So Achim uboachim lefanav. They're crying and screaming. Shneamar batukav kol eretz Yisrael, batisak ha'am el paro lelechem. It makes sense, by the way. They should go to Yosef. He's the head of their thing. Like, why are they crying to Paro? Vayomer Paro lechol Mitzrayim lechul Yosef. Go to Yosef. So what do they say? Halachnu etzleinu. We went to him. Umedaber lo nidvari mekim. He's like, whatever.
Did he ask crazy
stuff? He's nuts. Right? Sheomer mulu atzmechem. V'lo kach amar lecha mitchila. Didn't we say, Eved hu? Ve'ein devet ar darko she'ever linhog malchut aleinu.
Yeah.
You picked a...
Crazy
you picked a crazy man when he wants to make, right, he's not going to give us food.
A crazy man, you picked a slave. It's a caste issue.
Yeah, but he's telling us nutty things. Amar lehem shotim, you fools. V'chi lo haya kore lechem kol otam shnei tzova. V'tzoveach lechem hayu yodim shera'a ba la'olam. Like, you idiots. He's been telling you for 7 years this famine. Atem pashatim b'nafshotechem. You're liable for yourselves. Where's your food? You smart people. You're so smart. You don't like what Yosef says. Amrulo, they said, Yeah. It all rotted. This is what you were saying, Tracy. It's all gone. We did. It's all gone. Amar lahem lo nishtar lahem kemach me'etmo. Okay, fine, but where's yesterday's flower? Amulo af pat shahaya b'cheilenu ifsha. The bread in our fruit in our freezer is rotten.
Moldy.
Amar lahem, okay, he says, im gazar al hatvu'ah b'hir kiva, shema yigzor aleinu v'namut. If he decreed that our bread would... Meaning, the decree was two ways. The decree was 7 years plenty, 7 years famine. Meaning, they're like, this guy is more than just an interpreter of dreams. He's a determiner of futures. So if he has the ability, he determined the good. Now we see what he said is also true. Shema yigzor aleinu v'namut. Maybe he'll decree about us and we'll die. Ela kol asher yomar lechem ta'asu. Do what he says. Whatever he says, do. That interesting that Yosef herein is in a position of great power. He's got all the food, and they're also afraid of him. Like according to the Midrash. Why? Like otherwise.
Because this is a big thing that they have to do.
Yeah.
Why would he do that? Why would he? Does
he have to do it? He became contradicted.
So this is Rashi. Okay, this is the Rashi. Right? What if he decrees upon us and we'll die? What if he says, you know, I've been thinking about those dreams. Maybe it wasn't what I thought it was. It could be something else. No. Okay, we're fine. Brit Milah, everybody. Let's go. You know, like, he's a very powerful person. So the Kliyakar, who's one of my favorites, if you have Kliyakar, asks this very interesting question. Why in the world, according to the Midrash, does Yosef think that it's important for him to have all of Mitzrayim circumcised? What does he care?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well,
you know what I'm saying? Like, we know, by the way, why did Yaakov's sons have Shechem all circumcised themselves?
They had a plan.
Right, because they wanted to kill them all.
Right.
Okay? But here, like, Yosef has no plan. He wants to circumcise the civilized country in the world. It doesn't mean anything to them. Why would they circumcise themselves? Okay, so the Kliyakar says, he says a few reasons. I'm going to read you the first one, and I'll read you the last one. The first one is more mystical, more deep. Ta'amosh al-davar l'matzinu sha'orla nikret cherpa. The orla, the foreskin, is called cherpa. Busha u'cherpa. Okay? K'mosh ne'emar ki cherpa hilanu. It's a cherpa, it's an embarrassment to us to give our sister to an isha sha'orla orla. V'ra'av nikra gam kein cherpa. Yechezka calls ra'av cherpa. Al kein, therefore, chashav, shebahasarat cherpat ha'orla, yusar mehem cherpat ha'ra'av. He thought that the embarrassment of, meaning, why do we circumcise ourselves? God says, circumcise yourselves to be more whole, to be more complete. So he felt, Yosef felt this, like, what's wrong? Why is there a famine? There must be something, some spiritually missing in the people of Egypt. So we have to remove this cherpa of Orla. And Yosef isn't doing it because he's mean or terrible or whatever. He's trying to elevate them. Elevate them in a spiritual sense.
Exactly, one of the Shiva Mitzvot of Bnei Noach.
No, it's
not. How about getting rid of Avodah Zarah first? Isn't that more important?
Okay, that's his first answer. Okay? That's one answer. You see, he says, meaning there's this, there's something missing in the world. There's some, what?
It's kind of breadsticks. There are other things you can do.
Like,
I don't know. What Miriam was saying.
Get rid of the idolatry,
yes.
By the way.
That's more important.
Mila's a one time thing.
Mila's right, you can do it in one shot.
Mila's a one time. It's not a long term commitment.
The idolatry is so culturally ingrained. And by the way, if you bring about circumcision, it's a one time thing that you don't know what its effect is over long term, over generations. Like this is the custom of the Egyptians. You know, you have this practice, like Mila, is something that's deeply meaningful to Jews and Ishmaelim in a very real way.
And to the royal family.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, mazel tov. Okay. Okay. But Egypt has a different problem. The Kliyakar says something fascinating. Egypt has another problem. What's Egypt's other problem that Yosef has personally experienced? Anyone? Sexual immorality, right? If you think that this is a one-shot deal, that Eshet Potiphar, just one woman with one servant, let us not delude ourselves.
No, remember Paro with Sarah and Abraham.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
And the fear that Abraham had.
Mm-hmm. Although he did have to tell me he was Jesus'
sister. Okay.
Because he was afraid.
One second. Okay. V'od, Kliyakar says, Shamila tikkun ha'ever shelo yaber b'mishgal. It is the improvement of the male organ so that it should not be engaged in sexuality all the time. The Egyptians were completely immersed in inappropriate sexuality. And for this reason, they needed this tikkun, this improvement, during the famine. And as we all know, why did Yosef, why himself he felt he was saved? Why is Yosef a Ro'eh Yisrael? He's a shepherd of Israel because he was able to overcome his Yetzer. And Yosef felt that why is this famine happening? One reason this famine is happening is these people are, you know, like engaged in, you know this is about Noach as well, right? In the times of Noach, what caused the destruction? What causes the destruction of the world is improper immorality, improper sexuality. So Yosef felt, in order for me to bring about the repairment of the people of Egypt, I have to solve this underlying problem. And these people are engaged in this immoral society. And if somehow I can show them, and that would make sense, by the way, according to the Midrash, why they scream out? Yosef said, you got to fix this. And so what do they say? We don't want to fix this. We like this about us. He says, okay, you don't like it about us? Then you can die of starvation. Because if I can give you food for today, and I can give you food for tomorrow, but what's going to happen in another 50 years?
So how does that relate to all our terrorists?
I don't have the solution to the problem. But it's interesting to think about Yosef in that way, having a broader perspective, as concerned just not just about solving the problem, about solving the, you know, putting a band-aid on the problem, but looking at the underlying cause. The world is searching. I think the answer is the world is this. If you'd ask me, like there's a battle between East and West, right? The West represents on the one hand freedom, but together with freedom, this goes back to everything we talked about. Freedom brings with it tremendous problems. It brings with it tremendous dangers. And the West never learned to balance the freedom that it has with the idea of self-control. Right, with boundaries. There are no boundaries in the West. So this is the reaction in the East, the Muslim world, and says
only
boundaries. Only we're going to control our women. We're going to, you know what I'm saying? Of course, we'll use them for what we want or whatever, but in an evil way. There's this evil reaction. And there's this ultimate battle between values. What's the solution? And what do they say to the East? They say to the West, we'll take your freedom, we'll take your social networks, we'll take your personal expression, and we'll use it to destroy you. Yes. Right? The answer, of course, is the world, when the world comes in balance. When the world comes into balance and has this understanding of, on the one hand, freedom, but on the other hand, using that freedom in order to express ultimate moral values in the name of God. Right, that's what's going to be. That's the only solution. We're not going to get rid of Facebook, and we're not going to get rid of Avodat Hashem. But it can't be through killing and murder. It has to be through using Facebook to promote Avodat Hashem. You know, until the East won't learn its lesson, and the West won't learn a lesson until they all come to destroy each other. Right, and then we have balance. That's my answer.